Welcome to the sixth episode of the official SPGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Welcome back, everybody. Or if this is your first time, welcome for the first time. I'm in Kerkmend, a little town in Hungary, but I'm virtually in Holland, in the Netherlands. I'm with Professor Mark Benninga of Amsterdam, and I think Mark and Benninga are the only two words that I can say correctly in Dutch. We've just been through a little teaching session on how to say, for example, the name of the wonderful flower garden, Keukenhof. Did I get that right, Mark? No.
Well, almost. Like you pronounce my name, which is not Benninga, but the real Dutch pronunciation is Benninga, the ugly G from in Dutch.
I give up. Professor Benninga, Professor Benninga, and I are then now going to be having a little bit of a chat on his specialty within pediatric gastroenterology, which is disorders of bowel function that have to do with peristalsis, with motion, with defecation. And I think we ought to start with the question of, when do people realize that there's a problem with their baby?
That's a nice start, Alex, to start in the beginning of life. Well, it depends, because there are, well, two important matters. So first of all, if the child doesn't have meconium, the first stools, the beautiful color of dark green and black, has to appear. And in 99% of all babies, it appears before, in the first 48 hours. So if you notice that your baby doesn't feel well and didn't have any stools in the first 48 hours, then there might be a real problem. Because then, as you know, as a pathologist, then it might be the rare disease called Hirschsprung's disease. In all other cases, in more than 95% of all children, young and older children, we actually don't know what's going on. And we do think that most of the children withhold their stools, which is probably the main characteristic to become constipated. And this can happen at every age. So that can become in the first year of life, during toilet training, when you're older. And then, well, the parents notice that their children don't defecate, and sometimes in the very young child they don't eat, but in the older children, for instance, they don't defecate, but they also have fecal incontinence. And then some people think they're not toilet trained, but then it appears to be associated with constipation. So the answer is not very simple, but this is what it is.
You touched on an awful lot of stuff there, and you went at high speed. So I'm going to go back to the beginning again and ask us to take it. I think one of the advantages of not being a pediatric gastroenterologist as I approach this job of moderating is that I feel perfectly happy in saying, I don't get that. Tell me more. What's going on here? So, right, the baby can go home without having passed a meconium stool. But you tell the mom, you tell the dad, if the baby doesn't have one of those dark inky green stools, then you get in touch with us because something might not be right. Right? So the baby has an initial stool. What do you tell parents about a normal stooling pattern? Do you bother to tell them anything?
Alex, again, you touch a difficult topic. So what we did to reassure parents, we had a PhD, I think almost 10 years ago, answering your question, because yes, we do know that babies have frequent stools. So in the majority of babies who are breastfed, for instance, they have stools after every feeding. The same is true after having bottle feeding. But then parents are always a little anxious about the color, about the consistency of the stools. So this very nice PhD and myself, we bought ourselves a camera and made thousands of pictures of babies in the first year of life and turned this in what we call the Amsterdam Infant Stool Scale. So there is a list of pictures which shows you the consistency and the amount and the color of the stools in the first year of life.
So you've got green seedy, you've got yellow mushy, you've got brown sticky. Okay. Do you give a copy of this book to every baby, every parents who takes a baby home from your unit?
No, I don't do that. But in Holland and in every country, it's probably different. We have healthy baby clinics, and they sometimes provide these pictures for parents who are are interested in all these colors and amounts of stool. But for instance, in Taiwan, they made a very nice stool scale because they wanted to pick up biliary atresia, which is far more common in that side of the world than in our part of the world, to making these people aware that the color of stools, and that's very important if the color is pale, this is associated, as you know, with for instance, biliary atresia. And this, and so what I think they do there is that they indeed give all the parents with new babies these stool cards. But this is particularly for biliary atresia, not for constipation, of course.
That sounds like a brilliant idea. And I'm sure that it's helped, actually,
in terms
of
enormously.
Bringing kids
when
the Kasai hepatic portoenterostomy can still do some good.
Yes.
Well, we're not doing it in Holland because it's just too seldom a disease, biliary atresia. Okay. But you can't do everything, I understand. But the home visitor, the nurse who comes and takes a look at mom, takes a look at the baby, has that in mind, understands, knows what the stools ought to look like. I guess the next thought would be, if the baby isn't stooling appropriately, then you say to yourself, maybe there is a problem with innervation, or maybe there's a problem with the stool itself. When do you get your cystic fibrosis tests back as part of routine newborn screening?
Well, Alex, this is a difficult question for me because I don't exactly know the answer. Indeed, cystic fibrosis will be screened in the Netherlands. And yes, it will be performed in the first week of life. But I don't exactly know when we get the results back. But as you know, cystic fibrosis, like Hirschsprung's disease, is a very rare disease. So if there is what we call a meconium plug, then indeed we always think about these diseases. But then sometimes you have to wait for the result.
Gotcha. Then I suppose you also come down to thinking about, well, we've done the biopsy specimens and the hero histopathologist has reported from her laboratory that there are ganglion cells present and that the innervation pattern appears normal in the biopsies that were sent. Now you have to start to think about anatomy, don't you? Anatomy and how the pelvic floor and its innervation seem to be working. Or have I got the sequence wrong?
No, you're totally correct. However, if I honestly think and answer your question, I don't think that pediatric gastroenterologists will think about this mechanism that much. Although I have to say, for instance, since many years, we use the so-called Rome criteria. And one of the clinical entities within these Rome criteria is infant dyschezia. If you define infant dyschezia, you think about little infants who turn red and scream before or during defecation, and then all the problems are gone. We have no clue what happened and what happens. But we do think, and this comes back to your question, that these children contract rather than relax their sphincter complex during defecation. We can, of course, never measure this because we have no tools to do this, but this is our hypothesis. But again, in many children who develop constipation in the first year of life, we still think that these children contract rather than relax their pelvic floor muscles and sphincter muscles. And we suggest that this is based on painful defecation. Many infants in the first year of life, they start to develop constipation after the change, from breastfeeding to formula feeding. And then the consistency of stools changes, becomes harder for a short period. And this might be the reason that these children contract rather than relax their pelvic floor muscles. So that's how we think about it. If I go back to your question about motility and anatomy, well, I really don't have the answer, because we don't have the possibility to measure, for instance, colonic motility. There's no publication so far who were able to do this, and this is because it's hardly impossible to put a catheter in the colon and let it be there for a certain period. So that's why we don't have this answer. Another thing is, and this is the patients I see, some of these children already have have severe constipation, and if we look for causes, we can't find them. And then the question always appears: are these children born, for instance, with a megarectum? Huh. And again, there's no answer, because we don't have normal values. As you know, the radiation exposure is very high. So again, this is not a common test for these children, to answer your question.
I've got Mark here in your office is a 6-month-old who is having difficulty with defecation, and you've got a worried mama. Now what?
So you are lucky as a pathologist. You never come across these mothers who are anxious and begging you to help her and her baby with the problem. And indeed, we as gastroenterologists, we do, as of course the general pediatricians.
Oh boy!
So I really take the time to listen to her story. I ask about meconium production. I ask about breastfeeding. I ask about formula feeding. Sometimes I ask for allergies, although I think it's hardly present in these little babies. And then of course I ask for the defecation pattern, and I ask how frequent do these babies have defecation, because in really worried mothers, they sometimes make the problem bigger than it is. So if I ask for the defecation problem, to me it can be normal if the child defecates 5 times per week, and she is worried because it hasn't defecation every single day. But if the problems are really bad, so the child is crying and not thriving and has defecation once a week and is in pain, then of course I have to do something.
Go on. I'm trying to work the pump handle here, Mark. What are you doing in a case like that?
Okay, so then I really need to do something. So if the meconium production is completely normal, and I have no sign of an organic disease, which is the case in 98% of all children I see, then I start treatment immediately. And I never use a wait-and-see policy, which many general practitioners and general doctors in the Netherlands do. They give some advices about fibers, and they give some advices about putting oil into the formula, giving advices about how much the baby should drink. I never do this, because from research we do know that it's not helpful at all, and the longer you wait with treating these babies, it's more difficult to help them really properly. So I immediately start, if I listen to this, with laxatives.
Laxatives. I can see that it would be more difficult the more reinforcement this loop of defecation, pain, withholding of stool, attempts at defecation, pain, further withholding of stool. That's a self-reinforcing circle, isn't it? So laxatives are your first step.
Yes, because what we do think, again, why do we give laxatives? As you summarized, we think it's based on pain, and pain leads to withholding. And we need to get rid of this vicious circle and change the setting of the baby and make them conscious that defecation is not painful. And how do you get rid of pain? Well, you try to make the defecation more easy by giving them laxatives. And then the major and most important advice to these mothers, but also to the doctors, don't do it for a week, but continue it for at least 2 or 3 months, because laxatives are not dangerous. You can't get used to it. There are no side effects. So please use them as long as needed.
It takes a long time to forget something that hurts.
Yes.
And so the idea of giving the baby a good long spell of laxative treatment makes absolute sense to me. Right. I'm back with little Johan. He's now 12 months old.
Yes.
I've got all of the empty laxative bottles in my bag to show. See, I gave them all to you. I did. I really did.
Yes.
And he's still not quite right.
Okay. Which
way are your thoughts going now?
Well, in principle, my thoughts are exactly the same. And that's based on experience. It's bad to say this, but it's experience that in most of these cases, it's still functional. Of course, many people look for hypothyroidism and celiac disease and cow's milk allergy, but there are very nice papers which show that if you only have symptoms of constipation and no other sign for these kind of diseases, then the chance of having these diseases is less than 1%. So again, we need to treat these children, and then it's difficult. I play with different laxatives, so I use polyethylene glycol, I use lactulose, but also I use in these cases bisacodyl, because bisacodyl has a different mechanism and enhances contractions in the colon. So if you combine this with, for instance, polyethylene glycol or lactulose, you might have a better chance to evacuate. But then, of course, I know your question after this answer will be okay, but the child didn't respond with intensifying this laxative schedule. Okay,
damn.
Alex. Okay, Alex. And this for you as
he's ahead of me. Okay.
Yeah, and this for you as a English-speaking doctor is a problem, because then these ugly Dutch people are not afraid. are not afraid to use either rectal irrigation or even enemas, because it's so important to get the child in a different perspective. Because if he or she still withholds stools and only defecates once a week with a lot of pain, with a lot of feeding problems, then it's really necessary to do more than only oral laxative. So I'm not afraid to give it. I'm even not afraid to give it for a longer period.
Gotcha. Yeah, you were running into some deadlines here, aren't we, with the child needing to be put in. The mom wants to get back to work if she doesn't have other kids to take care of. And there's a spot in the kindergarten, in the nursery, and that kid is going to be under somebody else's care. You're going to have to... Time is pressing here.
Uh-huh. Okay. Again, this is a very difficult question, because we indeed face these problems in the Netherlands with kindergartens. And I don't know how it is in the rest of the world. But if children don't defecate, or more importantly, have fecal incontinence, which is the major sign of constipation later in life, then the people who are working in these kindergartens are not willing to change the diapers. So then these parents have a huge problem, because the people at the kindergarten think or say to the parents, okay, your child is not toilet trained, which is not the case. They are severely constipated. And we don't want to change the diaper. We have no time for doing that. So you have to come in yourself and change the diaper yourself.
That's hard line.
I know. But I'm always willing to call these people in the kindergarten and explain them what constipation is, that it's very common, like 3 to 10% of the children worldwide face these problems, and that it's associated with abdominal pain and with fecal incontinence, and it's not a problem of toilet training, and if they are willing to help these parents who face these problems every day and also sometimes every hour of the day.
Well, by now we've got a mom, or a set of parents, excuse me, we've got a set of parents and a child whose relationship to each other is maybe not what it should be. Mark, you're laughing at me.
I don't know these people. I only see all these very happy parents, all these very happy parents without any problems. Yeah. So what's your question about these parents? Because to be honest, how many people are really happy with each other if you face these daily problems? You have to be strong.
You have to be strong, but you also have to be able to call on support, and maybe support from people who are particularly well-trained in dealing with these issues. Mm-hmm. Do you have a team of psychologists in your encopresis clinic?
So again, Alex, your question is very valid. If parents can't get along with each other, and it indeed, to my opinion, influences the child, but not only defecation, I think the whole behavior. But I like to stress that, yes, I send these children to a psychologist I work with very closely. But I never leave these parents and children alone. So I take care of the laxative issues and try to help them and teach them how to do this and don't stop them, even if their grandparents or the neighbors tell them to stop the laxatives. And of course the psychologist can help the parents to address the other issues. And moreover, we showed, and I was really surprised, that approximately 30% of the patients with constipation coming to my outpatient clinic had a form of behavior problems like ADHD or, for instance, autism. And of course, I'm a pediatrician, and these problems should be tackled by other healthcare professionals.
It's a complicated business. No, I was confident that you wouldn't withdraw your support and throw them into the laps of the psychologists, because there still is a problem that needs to be dealt with in terms of laxatives and enemas.
Yes.
Laxatives and enemas, but you've been utilizing new pharmacologic agents and also investigating the utility of actual irrigation from above. Let's talk about some of that. When do you reach the point of saying, well, we have to take the next step and these are the next steps and let's move forward?
Mm-hmm. So, very importantly, you talk with somebody who is a referral center. So I'm the end of the line, and in this line is in the Netherlands. I always feel a little bit sorry that all the data in the literature come from academic centers. So it gives a wrong perspective what happens with children with constipation. So I assume, but I don't, there are no data, that 80% of all children who get advices about toilet training, rewarding systems, and some form of laxatives like polyethylene glycol or lactulose, I think 80 to 90% of the children is helped within 6 months.
Great.
So that's a very important message. So now you talk with an academic doctor who is one of his favorite topics is constipation. People in the Netherlands know this. So if they have treated these children for a longer period, 1 year, 2 years, then they send it to me. And then I have to come up with new strategies. So in the majority of cases, these children have already dealt with the conventional laxative therapies. Mm-hmm. Some of the doctors start rectal irrigation themselves, although they're not experienced with it, and they're sometimes anxious to start it. And then I think it's a cultural thing to start with rectal irrigation, because I think that many people in the world think we are cruel and should not do this in children. But, you know, the data are different than what people think, to my opinion. And so when they come to my clinic, again, I try to make the diagnosis as good as, or change it if necessary. But in the majority of cases, it's functional constipation. And then indeed, I sometimes do these trials where we investigate new drugs like prucalopride or lubiprostone, two very new drugs which were successful in adults with constipation. But then the interesting part is that, and I always have to explain it to people, that children are no adults. So we have to do these studies again and again and again in children. And very disappointingly, all the new drugs I was involved in and in big and large clinical trials failed. So placebos were as good as the new laxative. So yes, I used them, even if the trial showed it was not positive. But prucalopride is a cholokinetic, sometimes works. Lubiprostone, which attracts water via the chloride channels, sometimes work. But that's because all the other drugs failed. And then I intensively use colonic irrigation if nothing works.
Colonic irrigation, again, from above?
No, from behind.
From above,
it's very difficult, because then in the majority of cases, you have to take the children into the hospital and give them a what we call clean prep. I don't know if the same compounds, or the compound is polyethylene glycol, but you need to drink this substance for 2 or 3 liters, which is very difficult for children. And then we sometimes take these children in the hospital and indeed put a nasogastric tube in, and then via this tube we give this compound. But the taste is terrible. So
I've had a colonoscopy. I remember that taste.
Yeah, so you can use it as a maintenance therapy, but it's not done.
What do you do? I guess the idea of learn to live with it is about as far as we can go with some of these kids, isn't it?
That's disappointing. So that's very difficult for me. And I think we as pediatricians are really different than my adult colleagues. For instance, in the Netherlands, but probably in many parts in the world, people are not interested in constipation, because you can become 100 years old having a stool problem every single day, but you will never die because of constipation. It's long-lasting. If you are an adult, it's sometimes really difficult to treat. These people sometimes have behavioral problems, and then I never know if it's the cause of the defecation problems that these people come to have behavioral problems, or vice versa. Nobody knows. So the adult gastroenterologists are mainly interested in doing endoscopies and not talking with their patients. And we as pediatricians are patient, we take care of them, we take care of the parents, and we are... So that's why I don't want to give up. And then I make a decision to go on after I failed with my oral and rectal laxatives in those patients where, to my opinion, a socially unacceptable situation developed, which means that these children are dirty 24 hours a day. So they have problems at school, problems with their sports, problems at home because parents are angry, disappointed in their child. And in those very, very, very rare cases, we have a whole team, including a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a pediatric surgeon, other mental healthcare professionals, a general pediatrician. And then I bring in these very difficult cases what to do. And In some of these cases, we operate these children, and then you as a pathologist would be very disappointed, because then of course we ask the pathologist in these children if he or she can find any abnormalities in the muscles or the nerves or the layers in between, and in the majority of cases we can't find anything. So that's my frustration of doing 20 years of this work.
Right, smooth muscle pathology, innervation pathology, and specimens yes. like those that you'd be sending us, is it may be there, but we don't know how to recognize it.
And that's exactly. So in Great Ormond Street, they had this very nice pathologist, Viv Smith, mm-hmm. and we sent our biopsy to them because Peter Miller and his team in the old days published some papers with very rare causes for constipation. Mm-hmm. All the biopsies we sent were negative. So it might be the case that the Dutch are different than the English. I don't know.
Oh, definitely.
But that was really disappointing, because if a child doesn't defecate for a month, then there should be something going on, but in the majority of cases we didn't find anything.
Can't find it. You've touched on surgery and bringing a pediatric surgeon in for her contribution or his contribution. What sorts of procedures have you found useful?
Again, if I'm really honest, I can't answer your question. So there are little data in the literature about outcome of performing surgery in children with constipation, even in adults with constipation, and it all again shows you that people are not interested in this topic, because as I said, it's long lasting. There are behavioral problems, and adult doctors are not, well, capable is too much, but they're not very handy in taking care of these two problems. So that's why we have this team, including a pediatric surgeon. And then we do a few things, which is all new, and I don't know if we do it correctly. We do a transit study to definitely show that there is a slow transit of markers through the colon, which is mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. all these children in the case, but we have to be sure. Then secondly, we do a barium enema, which is for me new, and I didn't use it because of the radiation exposure, but it's helpful in these children because what we see in these children, they have either a megarectum or a what we call a doligo colon, mm-hmm. Which is also new for me. But the problem with the outcome of this particular tool is that we, of course, don't have normal values. Mm-hmm. So we assume that the colon is prolonged. So the combination of a marker study, the barium enema, and sometimes a difficography, which is also new for us to use. And then, very importantly as well, our psychiatrist or psychologist will call the general practitioner, will call school to get as much information about the family, because as we already discussed, behavior can be an issue as well. And if everything is negative, then we do a proposal to the parents to to perform either an ileostomy, or in some cases we suggest to do a subtotal colectomy with an anastomosis on the rectum. But all these kind of procedures are very risky. Mm-hmm. And not only that, mm-hmm. We have 80%, 80 complications. Mm-hmm. Which makes it also stressful for us to really give it good advice.
Gotcha. Mark, we've touched on a lot of things, and I think I've learned a lot, but we need to move on to something else. We're getting close to the end of the podcast time, and before we close, I definitely want to ask you about another behavioral issue, and that is, what is this I read in the field hockey literature about your being kicked out of the association because of obstreperous behavior on the field hockey?
Well, that's a nice question at the end. I was never kicked out as an active player, But they asked me to be the speaker in the stadium for certain games. So near
you
to our house,
the play-by-play, the commentary.
Yes, the commentary. Well, it's not a particular commentary, but you are in the high in the stadium,
yeah.
And then you mention the people who are playing. So you just mention the names, but you also come into play when there is a green or a yellow card, and then you are in play again. But if I am behind a microphone like this, I sometimes say things which are not appreciated, and this was the case during a certain game as well. The people laughed; they had a lot of fun, but the referee was not amused at all.
Tell me about the, and I'm going to say the last, I'm going to say your surname, and I'm not going to get it right, but tell me about the Beninja field hockey dynasty. Your sister, you, now one of your children?
Yeah, so I think this is a coincidence and a combination of probably talent and discipline, like you need to have in medicine as well. So my parents were particularly good athletes, but indeed my sister and myself were playing in the Dutch national field hockey team in the 80s, and my sister was doing much better than I did, because she became the first woman who carried the flag during the opening ceremony in Barcelona in 1992. So that was a huge honor, and she participated in three Olympics, and I participated myself in one Olympic in Seoul. But was also the doctor of the national hockey team in 2004 in Athens, which was also very nice, because as a doctor, I didn't do anything, because you are together with the most healthy people in the world at that time. So at that time, and I'm honest about it, I wrote a little book on constipation during the Olympics of 2004. And indeed, my youngest daughter, she's a good hockey player as well. But unfortunately, she just teared all her ligaments in her knee.
Oh, no.
Like I did in the Olympics of 88 as well. It's the same knee, the same injury, and hopefully she comes back healthy, but it takes at least a year before she will be back.
That's great. So even when working at the Olympics as the team doc, you managed to bring in the subject of constipation. Now that's dedication. Mark, that was great fun, and I think I've learned a lot. We generally end these podcasts with a request for the person being interviewed to name for us a song from his or her own country, in his or her own language most of the time, that will give us a little bit of an impression about the interviewer. You've already given us quite a few strong impressions. What about your song? What song would you like to recommend to the hearer, to those listening to this podcast?
Well, firstly, one song came in mind, and it's the singer is called Ramse Shafi, and the song is called Huil, Bid, Lach en Bewonder, which means cry, pray, laugh, and admire, is the translation. And he's a beautiful singer who doesn't live anymore, but I really love all his songs. But listening to your voice, I also thought about Wim Sonneveld, who is one of our former comics in the Netherlands, who was also a beautiful singer. And since I live in Amsterdam, most people know this song, and it's called Aan de Amsterdamse Grachten.
Along the canals also, of Amsterdam?
Yes.
Hot damn, I got it.
and that's also a beautiful song, and is, many people in Amsterdam love the song.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you, Mark. Once again, that was a lovely experience interviewing you.
Thanks, Alex. Hopefully, this podcast interested you in the very nice and long-lasting topic of constipation. Bye-bye.